Okay, what would you like to talk about? Yeah. About protecting groups? Yeah. Well, we talked about several different protecting groups.
I mean, the pure, the sugar protecting groups. That's why.
Yeah, the in sugars, there are lots of alcohol groups, and some sugars are ketones, but the ones we talked about have aldehydes, so the double bond is at the end of the chain, right? So you have reactions both of carbonyl groups and of alcohols. Right, and these things can react with one another, because alcohols can react with carbonyls first to give a hemiketal, and then with the second alcohol to give a full ketal. So you can have alcohols within the chain reacting with the aldehyde at the end of the chain. And depending on which alcohol it is within the chain, you get different sizes of rings. And one question that's of interest, or was of interest, still is of interest in sugars, is how big is that ring? Okay. So one way to do it is to is this what you wanted to talk about? Yeah. Okay. So one way to do it is to make some of the alcohols not reactive, so that the others will react, and then by studying the products you can find out which ones were still exposed. Okay? And the way they can react is, fortunately for the answering this question, is by forming the ring. The one that forms a hemiketal within the ring is sort of protected, but it's not very protected, because the hemiketal can go back and forth with the aldehyde and the alcohol coming on and off, either with acid or base catalysis. And if you want, we can go over the mechanism of how you form hemiketals with acid and base. But the interesting thing is that with acid, you can go to a full ketal, react with the second alcohol. Incidentally, that second alcohol can be another, it can't be another, in normal sugars, it can't be another OH within the same sugar. It can't reach within the same chain. It can't reach to form the second one there. But if you have another sugar molecule, the OH from that can form a full ketal. It would be the second alcohol that reacts to form two ether linkages to the carbon that was the aldehyde carbon. Right? And when you have that, when there are two alcohols hooked together in that way, that's called a disaccharide. Just a single one, either as a straight chain or as a ring, is a monosaccharide. If you got two of them hooked together, it's a disaccharide. In fact, that second one can itself have a separate aldehyde, which can form a second ether linkage, full ketal, to a third alcohol molecule. Right? What would you call that? Trisaccharide and tetrasaccharide and oligosaccharides, which oligo means a few, so you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. Or what would be the limit? What would be the name when you have a whole bunch of them? A polysaccharide, like starch is a polysaccharide. Okay, so it's forming these full ketals that link sugars together. We didn't talk about that in lecture, so that's not grist for the exam, but the interesting thing is that when you use acid catalysis to form a full ketal, then as long as you're dealing with basic reagents, it stays. It doesn't come back, right? So if you have that ring formed and lock it in by making a full ketal, then you can use basic reagents to your heart's content and do things to the other alcohols, the ones that are not involved in that ring in the chain. And then, we didn't go through this, but you can imagine analyzing the products in a way that shows you what other things got oxidized, and then you know which one, the one that didn't react, is the one that was in the ring. And by that time, you can have taken it out of the ring again by treating with acid and water, and the ketal goes back to the aldehyde, and that OH that was previously protected from reaction, because it was part of an ether, which is less reactive than having an OH, right? That one was protected. during that time. Okay. Now, often one thinks of these things protecting the aldehyde. But one point I made in class was that it not only protects the aldehyde, it also protects the alcohol. And what I was just telling you about is an example of protecting the alcohol to find out which alcohol did not react. So both things get protected when you tie them up as a full ketal. But once you put acid in there, then it can come, it can be in equilibrium with the open form, the aldehyde form, and you can get reactions of that. Did that make sense? Of forming a ketal?
Of the, well, it was a slide with the sugar.
Yeah, well, with I got to erase something here. It's probably on one of the slides here, so we could get it. Do you remember which lecture it was? Probably. I've got most of them loaded here. About 63, you say, maybe? 65. Okay, where are we here with sugars? Oh, I guess I did. That's what I did on the blackboard, wasn't it? Okay, so we're looking at whatever slide number that is, the one that shows the sugars. Okay, so this is a sugar molecule, glucose. It's called a hexose, because there's six carbons in the chain. Okay? We didn't talk about that in class. Okay, so it's an aldehyde at the end, and then alcohol, 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 alcohol. There are a lot of hexoses, different stereochemically, aldehyde hexoses, because you could have RRS here, RRS here, RS, 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 RS. So, but that's another point. Okay, so now, any of these, this alcohol can't attack the aldehyde to form a hemiketal or with another alcohol, a full ketal. Why? Pardon me? Why won't this oxygen attack that carbon, the carbonyl? Noel? Not, it's strain, ring strain, too small a ring, three-membered ring. Okay. How about this one? Noel, you're helping us here. It's still, a four-membered ring is bad. A five-membered ring is possible, right? A six-membered ring is possible. A seven-membered ring is possible, but it's a little too big, because you remember that the five-membered rings are flat. The shape of a ring with an oxygen is more or less like the shape of a ring with a carbon there. The angle's about the same at oxygen and carbon. Five ring was pretty close to flat, just a little bit bent into an envelope shape. The six-membered ring is quite puckered, right, axial and equatorial, all that. A seven-membered ring has to be even more puckered, and then things start, axial things start running into one another, right? So seven's not so good. But five and six are common. So on the left here is drawn a five-membered ring, although it's not drawn in anything like a realistic three-dimensional shape. But you see there's the carbon that was the aldehyde. Then carbon, carbon, carbon has the oxygen. So five members in the ring, right? And this is a hemiketal, right? When this alcohol attacked the carbonyl, and that the O of the carbonyl became OH, right? On the other hand, and that's called, that five-membered ring is called a furanose, because the five-membered ring with one oxygen in it is called furan. And the six-membered ring with one oxygen in it is called pyran. So the six-ring analog is called a pyranose. Ose means a sugar. Okay? So, and here this, the next carbon has used its oxygen to attack this one, making a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-membered ring. Okay? Now, these are in equilibrium, right? So if you tried to do a reaction with an aldehyde, you'd get a reaction of the aldehyde. Even though it's mostly in this form, whenever it gets over here, it reacts, right? And a typical reaction of an aldehyde, as we'll talk about soon, is to be oxidized, right? And in fact, if you oxidize it with the oxidizing agent being silver plus the silver cation, what do you get? If silver is an oxidizing agent, silver plus, what does the silver become if it takes on an electron? Becomes silver metal. And that's how mirrors are made. They're still made that way. You use sugar and a silver salt, right? And you get a mirror by depositing the silver. Okay, so this, even though it's mostly in this form, you'd get a mirror if you treated it with silver. Okay? But if you react these things with an alcohol, like methanol, say, okay, then what will happen? It's going to be acid catalyzed. So Nathan, you tell me where in order to react, where is the acid going to attack this thing? Okay, this OH up here. Now, why do you say that OH? It could, of course, protonate any of the OHs. They all have the same, essentially, energy of unshared pairs.
Because it's got a CO signal on.
Okay, the carbon to which that OH is attached has an oxygen attached to it. What's the advantage of that? You know what I would say? A naive point of view would be that that would be less reactive because this oxygen attached to that carbon would withdraw electrons. So this carbon would be a little more positive. It would withdraw electrons from this oxygen. Okay? And that would make the unshared pair on that O lower in energy, a lower HOMO, and less likely to be protonated, less reactive, a lower HOMO. The steric hindrance isn't such a big deal for protonated and oxygen.
I mean the
no, they're not very hindered. There can be cases where you could have a pair that's hindered, but this is not that case. Can anybody guess why it is we attack this O rather than these? Let me tell you that's a trick question. That in fact you attack all the O's. That is, protons go on all the O's, on, off, on, off, on, off. But what's special when it does it at the top? Jack? It's the next reaction that can happen, right? You can go on, off, on, off to your heart's content. But a reaction will happen when you protonate the one on the top that won't happen when you protonate the others. What's that reaction? This is important, so I'm going to do it on the blackboard here because it's the mechanism for making ketals. Right? So let's just do that on the board here. Do you get bored with going over that mechanism again and again? I think we should be getting it by now, because I've done it lots of times. So we have some RCOH, an aldehyde. Say it could be a ketone, let's say it's an aldehyde. Okay, and I'm going to treat it with acid and alcohol. In the sugar, the alcohol was special because it was in the same molecule. But we could have just a general R prime OH. Okay, so how does the reaction begin? Wojtek, what happens first? Let's do it with base first. Let's do both mechanisms, okay? So suppose you have hydroxide or alkoxide and RO.
So let's say that OH attacks carbon.
Yeah, OH attacks carbon, okay? So that'll give RCO minus HOH. Okay, and what will that do? What do RO minuses generally do? If you have an enormous amount of base, they can stay that way, right? But generally they don't. Amy? They'll grab a proton from someone else. If everybody was O minus, then there are no H's to grab. But generally there are other H's around. Because usually you don't have very much of this. It's just a catalyst after all. So you get OH up here. And what do you call that molecule?
Carbon.
That's a hydrate of the aldehyde, or a gemdiol. Okay? But now suppose instead of using OH, you used OR. Wojtek, you're going to keep us going here, but I'll do this with R here. Okay, so we now have the aldehyde part, OR and OH attached to the aldehyde carbon. And what do we call that molecule? Pardon me? It's a hemiketal. I can never keep this straight. When I took organic chemistry, there were different names for adding to a carbonyl that was an aldehyde and adding to a carbonyl that was a ketone. And you called the thing when you added to one ketal, that's a ketone, and if it was to an aldehyde, it was called an acetal. Now they're both called one thing, and I think it's ketal, but I can't remember which one. It's ketal? I think so. Okay, so but this is not a ketal. Ketal is when you have two R's on there. What's this called? Hemiketal. That's half a ketal. Now, if you continue treating it with, and a full ketal is the RCH with two ORs on it. Now, how can I get here? Starting from here with base and alcohol. Aisha?
Take a proton from the
OH. Okay, we'll take a proton from the OH and go to here. And then what? Amy? Pardon me? You can't get there from here with base. Because if you go here, you can't put an R on there because you don't have an R with a leaving group on it, right? If you had R chloride, R bromide or something, then maybe you could do this. But with alcohol, you can't do it. You can't displace OH minus from an alcohol in base. Okay? So the only thing this can do is this, and what does that make? That gets back where you started. That's just undoing everything you just did. So you can't get here with base. You can make a hemiketal with base, but you can't make a full ketal. Everybody with me? Okay, now let's do it again. And instead of using base, we're going to use acid. So we're not going to have OR minus around. We're going to have OH. Okay. So how is the reaction going to start now? If we're going to, we'll go to the left to make the reaction with acid. What's going to happen first? John, what do you say? I want to react this with acid. Where is it going to react?
The lone pair on the oxygen.
Okay, so proton will go on here, and that would generate this. I would draw it with a plus on the oxygen then, the trivalent oxygen. Could you suggest something else, John?
Lone pair on the HOR.
Okay. Now, how did that putting the proton on the oxygen, how did that affect the reactivity of the aldehyde? What is the reactivity of the aldehyde? What pi star. And how did protonating affect pi star energy? I'm going to pull this closer. How does plus charge affect electrons? Do they like seeing electrons? They don't like seeing electrons. Does an electron like seeing a positive charge? Not like seeing a positive charge? Right. So how does this change the energy of the pi star orbital if you put an H on here? It lowers it, right? So if it had a low LUMO before pi star, it's got a really low LUMO now, so it's much more reactive. So you don't need O minus to attack it. Just the unshared pair of the alcohol will now do the trick. Right? Okay, so now we have RCH OH on top, and OR H plus on the oxygen, because it was the alcohol. What do you do next? Okay, lose the proton. Obviously, a proton, truly in solution, doesn't just fly off. It goes to someplace else, like another alcohol. But anyhow, we'll just say it goes away like that. Okay, so now we have R, C, H, O, R. I could make these R primes, but I think it's clear what I mean by an alcohol, one that came from the alcohol. And down here we have OH up here at the top, and OR here. Okay, and what do we call that? A hemiketal. It's the same thing we got with base over here. Okay? And now, if you're dealing with acid, what do you do next, Luke? We have the hemiketal. Where, if you put a proton in, where will it go? Yeah, you could protonate OR. There are two oxygens. You could protonate either one. Suppose you protonate OR, what? You go back where you were before, you could reverse everything and go back. Okay? But what do you suggest? Why? I mean, you can, clearly, but what's the advantage of it? So now it can leave. And now why? So I'm going to have it leave with the electrons, and that's going to leave C plus R H O R on the carbon. Right? Why is that a good cation?
Secondary?
It's reasonable to call it secondary, but usually secondary is two carbons on the cation, right? This is a carbon and an oxygen, but it's sort of secondary. But it's better than that. Cassie?
There is
an oxygen. Yeah, it's... Compared to where it was originally, the unshared pair on the oxygen, it's now much better. And if we wanted to, we could draw a resonance structure that indicated that by putting these electrons in here. Now we have a trivalent oxygen, we draw the positive charge there. We could do it either way. In fact, that's the same thing, notice, that we had here, except that it's an R on the O rather than an H. Right? So this is a super reactive carbonyl kind of group. Right, the pi star of that's really low. Or you could look at it without drawing that resonance structure as just a carbon cation. So what's it going to do? Chris?
You
can have
the HOR.
Yeah. So another HOR will come up, O-R-H, and its unshared pair will form the bond. These will go out here now. Right, so now what do we have? So now we have O plus here, once it's used its electrons to attack here. How we get rid of that? Lauren? You see what I'm saying? I'm doing two steps at once here. So I made a new bond here. The oxygen is trivalent. When you have a trivalent oxygen, it's positive. But it won't stay there that way for long, the same way the O minus here didn't stay for long. What did the O minus do? It could do that. That's what I wrote here. But originally, if we were going forward, right, it would get a proton on it. Okay? What does this one do? The oxygen that has carbon, carbon, and hydrogen on it, and it's plus. Does it add a proton? What does it do?
Leaves.
What leaves?
Water.
Oh, it's true, water could leave. You could, or not water. There's only one H on the O, but HOR could leave, right? But that's just undoing what we just did. What else could leave? So that leaves C plus. So there are three things attached to the O, and one of them is going to give up its share of the electrons. They'll go on to oxygen, and then the oxygen won't be plus anymore. Are you with me on that? So the proton can leave, right? And its electron can go on there. And then what do you have, Lauren? What's the product when you've lost the H from here? Right, now we've got the ketal. So you see, by acid catalysis, we could go to the ketal. But by base catalysis, you could only go to a hemiketal. Okay? Yes?
Can we go, if we're moving on, can we go over 2DMS?
We'll go on next, but I want to make sure. So is that enough on this, Nathan?
I was also, I mean,
So the idea, oops, the computer's not, actually, I forgot to bring my power cord, or I, more properly, I brought the wrong power cord. So, what?
I have a power cord.
Oh, do you for Mac?
Yeah.
Yeah, then we can keep it going here. That would be good. Oh, I see. It was timing itself.
I'm hoping it'll stretch.
Yeah, there's an outlet right here. Great. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, this is me planning to study in the library like all day.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so this is all written down in the lower left corner of the sugar slide, right? You protonate the O, lose that, get that one, which is stabilized by the unshared, or stabilizes more properly the unshared pair next door. So that cation forms easily. Then the alcohol comes on, loses a proton, and you have the full ketal. And now as long as you avoid acid from now on, this carbon isn't reactive. It's only ethers, which aren't very reactive, the functional group on that. It's only an acid that can come on and cause it to leave. Right? So as long as you're treating with bases, you can do reactions that can react with the other alcohols. Or oxidation, for example, turns out to take place when you have alcohols next to one another like this. Right? So you can cut them out by oxidation and then see what's left, where it is in the chain. So that's the trick, and that's the protecting group for aldehyde and also for alcohol. And then we talked in that same lecture about other protecting groups, about a molecule that's designed specifically to protect alcohols. It's an enol ether. It's a six-membered ring. It has a double bond on the side and O on the bottom, right? So that was a protecting group for alcohols. How does that protect alcohols? Anybody got a way to start us here? Amy, you look like you're about to say something.
Yeah, you can, remember when
you... Do you suppose you use acid or base?
Acid.
Acid, and where will it protonate?
At the top carbon.
And why does it protonate the top carbon? Notice when it adds there, it would make plus charge here. Make it orbital on that lower carbon on the left.
It's either because of resonance or because there's an empty orbital that's stable.
So there's an empty orbital next to what?
Unshared
pair here. So that unshared pair gets stable. You could draw a resonance structure that has a double bond there. Right? So that's where you're going to protonate. And now what do you do next? This is the reagent you're using. Incidentally, I said you could call that an enol ether. It's got an R group on it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like that molecule is an enol ether. So you started with this enol.
Make it a double ether by putting the ROH.
So you have ROH come in. Right, its unshared pair forms a bond to here. Right, plus on the oxygen, and now what?
Get rid of
the
proton.
Get rid of the proton. Right. So now, what functional group do you have? Two O's on the same carbon, two ether oxygens on the same carbon. What does it call it? I can't hear very well. It's a ketal. Right, so this is a different way of making a ketal. This one, arguably, in the case of the sugar, what you're doing is protecting the aldehyde. Here, you never really had an aldehyde. This reagent was just added for the specific purpose of protecting the alcohol. So the alcohol is now, once you've lost the proton, is protected as an ether that can't unzip, as long as you don't have what?
Acid.
Yeah, because in acid, you can protonate that. It'll come off to generate the same cation and so on. So you can get it back again when you want it, but as long as you avoid acid, you've got it protected.
But once you get there in acidic medium, is there do you just sort of immediately have to extract it?
It depends on what else is the alcohol. Well, but you don't add acid and deprotect it until you've got it away from whatever threatened it.
Yeah.
Right? In an acidic, what you would do would be add water, right? So water would be the stuff that would go on this, and your alcohol would come out. You usually use the law of mass action to shift it one way or the other, right? If you lose water informing the ketal, which you do, right, then what you do is distill water away, and then you form the ketal. Then you add a whole bunch of water, and the reaction will go the other way. Okay. And we talked about one other protecting group, too. Remember what the other kind of ether was, a special kind of ether? Ellen, you remember? It's here. It was THP. THP was that stuff I showed you there. Okay, that's the THP ether up at the top. But the other one is TBDMS. Does anybody remember what TBDMS stands for? T-butyl, dimethyl, silyl. Right? So it's an ether where instead of having a carbon on the oxygen, you have silicon, the element below carbon. Right? So that's here someplace, isn't it? Yeah, here. Okay, so you start with the chloride. This is a little bit like a tertiary chloride, right? Except it has silicon there. And the difference is that then when the ROH attacks it, it can actually, because silicon is a down a row, it's got vacant d orbitals, so they can stabilize these electrons without breaking the chloride away. So you form a new bond, and that, now you have a pentavalent silicon, but then it can lose chloride. So it's not like an SN2 reaction or SN1. It's association followed by dissociation, as it says here. Okay, so you get, and then you lose the proton from the ROH, the chloride's gone away, and now you have an ether where you have your R on one side, your alcohol that you're protecting, and silicon on the other side instead of carbon. Now, an advantage of that is that the silicon-oxygen bond is much stronger than the silicon-chlorine bond, right? 90 kilocalories, 110 kilocalories. So that makes the reaction come this way. Okay, so now you have this, and it's an ether, and it doesn't react with things. But now the way you take it off is different. You have a special way of deprotecting this. And the way you deprotect it, is to react with fluoride. Now, fluoride's not a strong nucleophile. Remember, it wasn't a good nucleophile in SN2 reactions. But it has a special affinity for silicon. The silicon-fluorine bond is worth 135 kilocalories per mole. That's really strong, right? Another 25 kilocalories per mole downhill from the ether, silyl ether, right? So fluoride will attach to the silicon, and then you'll keep the fluorine-silicon bond at 135 and lose the silicon-oxygen bond at 110, right? So now that comes off, and you have your alcohol back again. Yeah. Yeah, it's an association dissociation too, because silicon has that ability to form extra bonds since it's further down in the periodic table and has vacant d orbitals. Okay, so we talked about three kinds of protecting groups: ketals, this special kind of ketal here, which is I also drew on the board up there, the THP ketal, and then the silyl ether. And there are many, many, many protecting groups, which is a good thing. Because in a complicated synthesis, you have lots of different functional groups in the molecule, and many of them would react with the same things. So you want to protect a bunch of them, but then be able to expose at will which other one when you want something else to react. So to have silyl ether that you can take off with fluoride, and a ketal that you can take off with acid, and other things that you can take off with other things is really handy. So protecting groups is a big aspect of complicated synthesis. Okay, now I think we've done enough of that, do you? But it's really important to be able to see how ketals and hemiketals form and acid and base catalysis. And arguably I shouldn't do all these things on the PowerPoint with the curved arrows and so on, because it just sort of, you know, flashes by you and so on. And if I were actually doing it on the board and drawing them, you might get the idea, you'd have to do it on your paper too, and you might earn it that way and earn and learn, right? But what I'm trusting that you as adults or budding adults will do is spend the time to draw these things yourself. You know, when it comes up on a PowerPoint slide, before you click and see the arrow come in, draw it yourself so you know that you're master of it. Okay, Amy, now you said you had something to talk about.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could just like quickly explain 2D NMR a little bit. Is that what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, I didn't. Lecture which, you said?
62.
So, I didn't really explain it. So don't think that I thought you understood it.
Yeah.
Okay? I just showed the result. Let me get down to... Okay. And, pardon me?
They'll give a really good explanation section, which is like, there's one NMR spectra here with the temporal shifts, and there's another spectra on other axes.
Yeah, well, what you do is there are two... You're using two different radio signals at the same time. And one of them will be of a frequency to hit certain nuclei, and the other one will be such as to hit other nuclei. Okay? But if those two nuclei are interacting with one another, it certainly doesn't surprise you that doing something to one of them will influence the other one. Right? So now you can scan these frequencies. You can scan one of the frequencies and scan the other frequency, and you'll get special response when they're hitting two protons that themselves are connected to each other, for example. Okay, by spin-spin coupling. Okay? So, or another way of doing it is to have set one frequency so that it's on one particular atom. Right? One nucleus. And then scan the other one, not at the same frequency, until you hit something that causes this one to respond, the one you're looking at here. Right? Now, there are fancy ways of doing this very efficiently called Fourier transform spectrometers. And it's a little complicated, but it's essentially the advantage of it is that you collect a lot of these data at the same time. You don't just sit on one and scan, then sit on another and scan, then sit on another and scan. There are efficient ways to do that. But it was not our business to talk about that. So essentially, this is scanning, hitting, this is one frequency hitting certain protons. This is the other. And you see a peak when they interact with one another. And of course they interact when they're both hitting the same proton. Right? And that is on the diagonal, where this frequency is the same as this frequency on the diagonal. Okay? But what's interesting in this is off-diagonal peaks, because that's when hitting one proton with this frequency has an effect on what you see with a different proton. And that means those protons are close together in space in this particular thing, so that they're close enough to interact. Okay? So every place you see one of these peaks that's off the diagonal, that means that those two different protons that correspond to those two different frequencies, right, are close to each other. In particular, they're within 6 angstroms of one another, tends to do this. Okay? And another way of presenting the same information is shown just a little bit later here, where it's an actual 3D plot. Sorry. No. There. Right? So here's one frequency, here's the other frequency, and now you see peaks sticking up. It's just a different way of presenting the computer presenting the same information. Okay, so these ones on the diagonal it's just the same as if you were using only one frequency, right? But the ones off diagonal tells you what's interacting with something else. Now, in that first case, the interaction, and I guess I'll go back there, this one. So in this one, this is just a small range of the spectrum between 6.5 and 9 parts per million, but it's the region of the spectrum where in a protein the NH protons come. So there are lots and lots of them in a long chain of this stuff, right? And if all you had was a normal spectrum and looked along here, it would be very congested. All these peaks would be on top of one another, and it would be very difficult to know what's going on. But you have, they're much more spread out in two dimensions. So what was done here, or what I illustrated, was you take, say, one frequency, like the NH that has this frequency, and now you see what other frequencies respond, influence that peak somehow when you hit other protons. And you see there's a peak here, there's a peak here, there's a peak here, and here, and here. There are peaks here, here, and here, close to that. Okay? So those are from other protons that are near that proton. And so they came at a certain frequency, right? Now you can go to that frequency. So you can start with a proton here. There's a proton here that's near it. Now you come down here where that proton is. So this is that other proton that was talking to this one, right? And now you go out and see it's not only near that one, it's also near this one. So this one is near this. So there, you know, there are three or four or five maybe other protons near each proton. So now you begin to develop this map of who is near who. And if you have, and if you have other constraints on what the structure has to be, that is that successive NHs aren't an arbitrary distance from one another. They have to be a distance that's consistent with this bond distance, this, 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 and the next H, right? And reasonable angles. Right, so if you put in these constraints in a computer program and know what's, then it turns out there's only one structure that will give all these things. So this is a way of determining three-dimensional structure of something, which has what advantage over X-ray crystallography? X-ray crystallography is ever so much more detailed. What? It doesn't have to be a crystal. So you can use proteins that don't crystallize, things that are in membranes and things like that. Membrane proteins don't crystallize easily, typically. Yeah?
I have a feeling this is a stupid question.
I can't hear very well.
I have a feeling this is a stupid question, but how do you get correlation by through space magnetic interaction?
No, it's not a stupid question at all. But it's true that it averages to zero on tumbling, but they still... But depending on how fast the tumbling is, there can still be a residual part of it. And if you have a protein, which is a pretty big molecule, it's not tumbling very rapidly. So it doesn't average completely. Right? And I'm not sure, there may even be mechanisms that survive even with rapid rotation. I don't think so. Not, it's not for the through space part, but for proteins, that's special because they don't tumble really fast. Wait a second. They have to tumble fast enough that you get sharp peaks, because molecules in different orientations would have different chemical shifts. Can you think of any example of that? Where a proton in a certain molecule, its chemical shift would depend on the orientation of the molecule. Can you think of such an example? Pardon me?
Benzene.
Benzene, the ring current that's on and off, right, depending on the orientation of the molecule. So, I have to think about how the coupling survives when the tumbling has to be rapid enough that you don't have all different positions of frequencies for the same proton with different orientations of the molecule. And I'm having trouble constituting that. There could be... if it's tumbling at a certain frequency and these things talk to one another, then the field this one sees goes up and down as this one moves around. You can see that. If this one's like this, it's pointing one way here. When it's up here, it's pointing a different way over here, a different way. So as it tumbles around, you get an oscillating field at this that this proton sees, which is just like being hit by a radio frequency, right? It's an oscillating field that this sees. So that can cause it to flip. You know, you send in a field to make things flip. So that kind of thing obviously would influence the the behavior of that thing if it's getting a frequency that makes it flip or close to. So that can happen too. So there really is a great deal of sophistication about really doing NMR, and we haven't talked about that, and I don't think we better.
It's not an exam we don't have to
do. What?
It's not the exam.
No, but this idea of correlation is an interesting one nonetheless. Just take it as a qualitative fact without understanding the mechanism in detail. But that's a very good question, Wells. Yeah. I can't hear Rua.
When you're looking at 2D at Mars,
yeah.
Is there an element of, is there like a, you know, you can see like in using this integration to interpret regular NMR spectrum, is there an analog in this 2D spectrum? I'm trying to look for
it. How much one proton, those off-diagonal peaks, their strength, would depend on how strongly one influences the other. And if it were simple, you might think the strength of that signal will tell you what that distance is. Right? And then that would be really powerful. But that doesn't work. They can't use that because it's just complicated in a way that doesn't work out well. So all you can see is that it's one is tickling another one, but you can't use something like integration to tell how far or how many or something like that.
So it's like they're like different sizes of the dots on the spectrum.
Oh yeah, so there are different strengths of interaction, but predicting them is really hard. Yeah. On the diagonal is what you see for a 1D spectrum. But the off-diagonal peaks that depend on these interactions, in one case, I showed two examples of 2D spectra. One was where the distance is what makes the difference. The other is where a proton that's in one position at a later time is in a different position. And now if you fiddle it and make it point with and against the field in this position, when it gets over to the other position, it's also pointed with or against the field. So having done something here influences what's happening here because the proton went from one site to another. Right? So that's a completely different phenomenon going on, but it's another type of 2D where the signals at one point at one frequency influence signals at a different frequency, and you can get information about it. In that case, you can get how rapidly it goes from one place to another, right? Which showed that you had 1-2 rearrangements, not 1-anywhere rearrangements. In fact, the first person who showed that in that compound was Professor Saunders in our department. But he didn't do it by 2D NMRs. He did it by a different technique and then told this guy in Switzerland about it who did it by 2D. And the guy in Switzerland got the Nobel Prize, not for that particular experiment, but for inventing the idea of Fourier transform as an efficient way to do these 2D NMR experiments. Yeah. Yeah, you get peaks in that thing that we just flipped by us here. You get peaks here. So these are the diagonal. The off-diagonal peaks come when a methyl at one place in a shortish time gets to a different place. But if it takes longer to get to the different place, then the way this experiment was done, you don't get a peak if the time is too long. So you see where they go in the first rearrangement, but you don't see subsequent rearrangements in this particular one. You could do it. Things like this often depend on using pulses of radio frequency, and you time between the pulses, right? And the time that was involved between the pulses was long enough to get to have one rearrangement, but not to have many rearrangements. Yeah, so then you can measure rates that way. Mm-hmm. Wells?
Sorry, what exactly does the ABCD signify?
These are different. ABCD are the different chemical shifts, right? They labeled this. This was DCBA. That's the diagonal. That's the normal thing, and they're different chemical shifts if you were just doing a normal spectrum. And you can see some of them are near the positive charge, and they're shifted way down here. And some are far from the positive charge, and they are way up there. That makes sense. Okay? But if you have the rearrangement, if this red methyl group moves from here to here, right, a 1-2 shift, that is, it goes down to this structure. Not only, this red one is still in an A-type position. The A position is on a carbon that's far from the cations, right, where there are four things attached. Okay, so this red one stayed A, right? But this red one, which was an A, is now a C. So the one that, the peak that was here, the proton that was here, in this, before the rearrangement, is in the position C after the rearrangement. And you see a peak here that shows that A went to C. And also, at the same time, of course, C went to A. You could run the same, could go backwards, right? So you can go around here and see, when you do this, which ones become which in a single 1-2 step, 1-2 rearrangement. But if it was a 1-anywhere rearrangement, which we had, I think, in the previous, or someplace here, the alternative. The alternative could have been what's at the top here. Whoops, it was there. I should turn off the automatic timing here. Here. So there's the 1-2 methide shift. But an alternative could have been that the methyl went above the center of the ring and then could come down anywhere. So it could start at 1 and end anywhere. Then all these peaks would have been connected to one another, because in a single step everything would have gone everywhere. Or at least that methyl would have gone everywhere. No, pardon me. The methyl that moved, when it sits back down again, is still on the same kind of position it was before, where there are two methyls on the same carbon. But the other ones are the ones that shift. But they could shift from any position to any position if it had been the one anywhere. But that's not what you see. You see only certain off-diagonal peaks, which show that it was a 1-2 shift. Kate, you had a question.
I had a question, but it wasn't about this.
That's okay. Unless, do people have other questions about this that they want to address? Okay, Kate?
Okay, in lecture 62, I was just wondering if you could briefly go back over double labeling for carbon 13.
That is 62. So it should be here. We'll do here. Oh, here. So first, single labeling. So the idea is that this stuff is made, I forget what makes this one, but whether sometimes they use plants, but I think this is done with some animal enzymes or something, or enzyme complex, I don't know. But anyhow, they used the biological system to feed it the starting material for the material for this lanosterol that they're studying, and then put a magnetic label in carbon 13. So normal carbon 13 is what percent? Do you remember? It's 1%. So you get just weak signals for all the different carbons. But if you specifically put in one carbon of the starting material like that one and make it say 50% C13 at that position, then the corresponding peaks in the product that came from that will be 50 times stronger. So you'll see where they are in the product. So if you label that one, then if according to the way we said squalene was made up at the top, you get those enriched C13s would be in all that position. And then if you follow through and bend it around and do the mechanism that we were suggesting, then these particular carbons should stand up in the NMR spectrum, and they do. So that's confirmatory. Right, and now you could do other carbons too, like the blue one, and then it should be those that are there, and indeed the right ones are labeled. But as far as strict logic goes, you don't know that this went directly to that. It could have been that this was degraded, and that those particular methyl groups, you ate it up, but they became something. And those then became this, in principle, right? That other thing. But if this went intact, then the atoms should not only survive, but they should be in the same relationship to one another that they were originally. So you could put two labels in, right? Now, at first glance, it looks like this is just doing two experiments at one, and in fact, not as specific, because you don't know which one it came from, right? But it's much more powerful, because if it got cut apart, if you do it dilute, right? If you made it 100% labeled, then however, you know, if it chewed up and then the pieces got incorporated, they would still be labeled when you put both of them in. But if you make it dilute so that most of the molecules don't have any label in it, that is, you synthesize things double label, quite strong, 100% double label or 90%. Okay? Then you dilute it with unlabeled stuff. So only rare molecules have a label. But when they're labeled, they have two labels. Okay, so that's the dilute, double labeling. Okay, and now when you make the squalene, it's going to be, there will be no molecule that has labels at lots of positions in the molecule because it was dilute. But there'll be some that have the label at the far left there. But when they have it, they'll have two. Okay, and now if those get into the product, from that position, they come in here, according to the mechanism we said. So now, not only do we know that there will be a label here, we know that these two came in as a pair. Because when we look at the NMR spectrum, how do we know that those two C13s are not only at this position and this position, but at those positions in the same molecule? Right? It could be that one molecule has the label here, but a different molecule has the label here. Right, and you'd see those two peaks in the NMR. Right? How do you know that they're in the same molecule?
If they're next to each other, aren't they going to split?
Yeah, they split each other, but they can't split each other if they're in those positions in different molecules. They have to be in the same molecule. So, but now you did that, right? So you know that. And then you look at other, there'll be different molecules that have those labels in other positions. So there'll be some that, so you'll see a double doublet at those for those chemical shifts. Right, and then you go to other positions like there and there and there, and all those signals are going to be double doublets, right? But when you go to those, that's not a double doublet, right? Because these moved away from each other. They were adjacent to one another there, but now they're too far apart to show splitting. So now you see just two singlets. So that double labeling really was much more informative than the single labels, because it showed that those things moved together or moved apart rather than just where one particular carbon ends up. Okay?
If you didn't do it dilute, then every carbon would split every carbon.
Yeah, then if they were all there, then everything would split and you wouldn't have any information at all. Yeah?
It wouldn't just be the combination of the first two experiments, though, because you had all the splitting.
But in the first, but you label only. If you labeled every carbon, then everything would be splitting. But you don't label every carbon, even if you do it not dilute. If you label only this carbon, right, there aren't other carbons near it, right? But labeling those two together is what gives the splitting information. Cassie? Yeah, you get to measure the frequency of something precisely. You have to you do it by matching the light wave to the natural frequency of the vibration of the thing, right? So if all you do is put on a really short pulse of light that goes up, right? Then lots of different frequencies the atoms are going up. So you don't distinguish among the frequencies. What you have to do is have your wave go long enough that it stays in phase with a certain frequency, but not with a nearby frequency. Right? So now, how long does that pulse have to be in order to distinguish two frequencies? And what we showed in the plot, which I could go to if you want to, but probably we don't need to, is that if you had 20 hertz and 21 hertz, That's 20 cycles in a second and 21 cycles in a second. If you go for a whole second, right, the wave that exactly matches one will get completely out of step with the other one. So it will interact with one if it's a pulse that's a second long, but it won't interact with the other one, right? If they differed by 2 hertz, then you only have to go half as long for them to get in and out of phase with one another, right? So to distinguish things, you have to measure long enough that's the inverse of their difference in frequency. That is, if they differ by 2 hertz, you have to go half a second to tell the difference. If they differ by 1 hertz, you have to go a whole second. If they differ by 10 hertz, you could do it in a tenth of a second to see whether they're going in. But now, that's fine. So it just means you have to have your light long enough to tell precisely what the frequency is. No big deal there. Okay. But suppose the frequency changes while you're trying to measure it, right? Then, as we showed, for something that would vibrate at 20 hertz for a while, and then at 22 hertz for a while, and then at 20 hertz for a while, then at 22 hertz for a while, if it's going back and forth, the overall shape of the wave matches very well with the average frequency, right? So then you get a sharp peak. Only one frequency works, but it's the average frequency. Does that make sense to you? Okay, so how fast do they have to jump back and forth? Right? It has to be as fast as their difference in frequency. Right? So if one frequency is 20 hertz and the other is 22 hertz, and they jump back and forth twice a second, they differ by 2 hertz, then that's enough to cause it to match the wave that's the average frequency. Right, so now if you have two different peaks and they're not, and the signals giving rise to them, like protons precessing it in different local fields, or like two OH bonds vibrating at different frequency, if their frequency difference is large compared to is large, then you get sharp peaks. But if they're jumping back and forth rapidly compared to that difference in frequency, then you just see an average peak. And I showed this how it changed if you smoothly change the, like changing the temperature to change the rate. It starts as 2 sharp peaks, then they begin to broaden, then they coalesce in the middle, and if they're going back and forth really fast, you get just 1 sharp peak. Okay? And they just begin to coalesce, those 2 peaks, broaden and then coalesce, when the frequency is about 1 over the difference in frequency of the, when the rate is about 1 over the difference in frequency of the two. So if you can go to really low temperature and see how different their intrinsic frequencies are, then you go to higher temperature where they're moving faster, and you can measure how fast it is when they just coalesce. You see what I mean? Because it's the whatever that, if the two differences in frequency were, if the difference in these 2 peaks was 20 hertz, then when they're going 20 times a second from this site to this site and back, right? Then those 2 peaks will just begin to come together. Okay? Now in IR, the 2 frequencies of the OHs, the one that's hydrogen bonded and the one that's not hydrogen bonded, those 2 frequencies are enormously different. Right, I forget what I gave the number, but it was 10 to the 11th hertz, right? So they would have to average those 2 peaks and have them coalesce. They would have to be changing from being hydrogen bonded to not being hydrogen bonded 10 to the 11th times a second. And that's just not plausible, because that's how fast atoms move, sort of. It's not how fast they change their chemical site, right? So because IR frequencies are so high, and therefore the differences are so high, you don't get average in the IR. It is possible to get average in the IR, but you need you're measuring really fast processes, right? Whereas in the NMR, the differences are just matters of hertz or hundreds of hertz or kilohertz maybe, right? So you can measure rates that are much slower in NMR. That is, they average much more quickly. Do you see what I'm saying? More easily. Relatively slow processes give an average in the NMR if they're only 1,000 times a second. But the average in the IR, they would have to be 10 to the 11th times a second, something like that, or whatever it was I said. It's a little bit unusual in a course like this to talk about that, really, about what really causes it. So if you stay with this subject, you'll get it again later on, and you'll get it more rigorously. So this is just to show you what neat stuff is to come.
So like averaging would be like, so that the splitting of that OH group average into one of each.
Yeah, well, what we said was that if you look at the OH signal in the NMR, you see just a single peak, but it tends to be a little bit broad usually, right? So it's something that's changing from being hydrogen bonded to not hydrogen bonded, or more so than that, because that's pretty fast on the NMR time scale. It's going from the H going from being bonded to one oxygen, whose neighbor CH2 is, say, oriented that way, to go and being bonded to a different oxygen whose CH2 neighbor is that way. Right, actually breaking bonds and forming bonds, not just hydrogen bonds, but actual covalent OH bonds. So that's a much slower process. But still, it's fast compared to the difference of frequency of those two different states in the IR, in the NMR. So you see broadened peaks. And the average position of the peaks, there are some of the OHs in an alcohol sample are hydrogen bonded. Others aren't hydrogen bonded. Those will have very different chemical shifts. But those are changing so rapidly that they average really quickly. But breaking the bond and going from one molecule to another is slow. Okay? So the chemical shifts all come out the same. That is, they get averaged. But the splitting may not be quite the same if the H's aren't jumping from molecule to molecule. That is, it can change from being hydrogen bonded to not hydrogen bonded, but it's still connected to the same molecule and has the same neighbors, right? Okay, but then that OH, the splitting by the neighbors, you know, like a triplet splitting or something like that, if it has two neighbor protons, that can go away when you put acid in or something and a proton goes on one oxygen and that nucleus then goes to a different one and then goes to a different one and a different one. So if you use DMSO as the solvent, which hydrogen bonds tightly and therefore doesn't let the OHs get away, right, then you see that splitting. But you don't see it otherwise. So then the question we asked was, why do you see only one chemical shift in the NMR, meaning whether it's hydrogen bonded or not doesn't make any difference, it's averaging. But if you look at the IR, you see different peaks for ones that are hydrogen bonded and not. And the difference is that in the NMR, the frequency difference between being hydrogen bonded and not is a few hundreds of hertz or something like that. Whereas in the IR, it's 10 to the 11th hertz. Okay, so the time scale of averaging has to do with the difference in frequency of the two things that are doing the averaging. Yeah.
In lecture 61, we talked about...
In what? Which? Yeah.
We talked about higher order effects.
Yeah.
Can we go over the bit where it causes the separation of the doublets?
Yeah, okay. Okay. This is another one that's... somebody who teaches one of the other elementary courses came and asked me why that happens, right? And then I started explaining, and then I thought, gee, that would be fun to tell you about. So not many people know it, really. Okay, so remember the idea is that the doublet you get here from two hydrogens. Whoops, what happened? Oh. Okay, don't send, sorry. Let's see if I got it here. Lecture slides, spring, and 61 it was. This is, I don't know what's going on here. I'll try once again. If not, we'll have to. 61. Anybody got any ideas other than rebooting? Okay. Yes. Sorry. I think this explains much better with pictures than with my telling about it. So I think we better wait till this reboots to go through that. And in the meantime, we'll talk about something else. But remind me to get back to it.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
We compared 800 megahertz with 100 megahertz
and yeah.
on NMR.
Yeah.
We talked about three factors. The Boltzmann.
Yeah, that's about the sensitivity. Right? Okay. So, one thing we didn't talk, we stressed there are two states for protons with and against the field, a favorable and an unfavorable orientation, right? Now, if there were exactly the same number with and against the field, then they would cancel one another in their effects, right? When you put the right frequency in, one will go from low energy to high energy, but the other will go from high energy to lower energy, and they'll exactly cancel out. The only way you can get a net signal is to have more oriented in the favorable than in the unfavorable way. Okay? So what determines how many are favorable versus unfavorable? It's how different their energy is at equilibrium, right? Now, the energy difference depends on how big the field is that they're interacting with. So there's a certain energy difference. If you make the field twice as big, there'll be twice the energy difference, and therefore, roughly, twice the population difference. The population difference is very small. It's a part in 20,000 or something, or a part in 4,000 or something like that. But very few more of one way than the other. So if you can double that, which you more or less do by doubling the frequency, you get twice the sensitivity. Because it's like having twice as many molecules that you're studying.
What's the effect of energy quality?
Okay, but in the higher field, the precession is actually faster, right? Or the energy difference, you can look at it two different ways. You can look at how much energy is needed to go from the low energy to the high energy. And as you get a bigger field, it's a bigger quantum leap. Or you can look at it as the frequency of precession. At the higher frequency, they're precessing faster, and you have a higher frequency of light that interacts, which is a higher energy, which is the same thing. It's two different ways that don't, at first glance, look like they're the same thing, but they are. The energy difference and the precession frequency, right? So the light that you're using is a different color, right? And it's not surprising to you that detectors of infrared light are not as sensitive as detectors of UV light per quantum, because you get a lot more oomph out of a blue photon than you do out of a red photon. Okay? And the same thing is true when you have a higher field. You have a different frequency, radio frequency you're dealing with, and it's more sensitive to detect it. Okay, so one is that you have more molecules doing the net excess low energy ones that are absorbing. A second one is that the frequency is more sensitively detected. And the other one is that the electronics are better. Even if you had the same punch, you get different sensitivity of electronics at different wavelength ranges. And that's pretty technical, and I don't understand it. But Professor Zilm, who does understand it, or at least says he understands it, tells me that it goes more or less with the cube of the frequency. So you get a lot of, you get something for the extra money you pay for those big magnets in terms of being able to study very dilute samples or very big molecules, so you don't have very many protons of any given type in that big molecule. So just a second here, let me get this going. I haven't had that trouble before. I don't know what the what's going on. Anyhow, so is there another question, Wells? Oh yeah, absolutely. So remember, you can talk about the light in terms of its frequency, right? So, and that's the unit and frequency is energy, and that's the proper unit to use when measuring the interaction between two protons, the spin-spin interaction, because it's a certain energy. It doesn't make any difference how big the field is. The interaction between these two protons is whatever it is. Okay? But the chemical shift has to do with how big the field is, because the circulation of the electrons that causes the chemical shift is itself caused by the field. So if you double the field, you double the amount of induced field that's causing the chemical shift. Okay, so the chemical shift differences in frequency, in energy, get bigger, right, as you use a bigger field. But the spin-spin splittings don't get bigger, right? So there's several advantages. So making a bigger chemical shift causes things that would be on top of one another no longer to be on top of one another. So you get separate peaks for different protons when they'd all be on top of one another in a lower field. So that's obviously an advantage. And another advantage is you get simpler splitting patterns, because you don't have to worry about those high order effects when the chemical shift difference is large compared to the J coupling, the spin-spin coupling. So let me now try to see if we can do this. Lecture 61. If this fails, I don't know what to do. Actually, I'm doing PPT. I could try PPTX, I suppose. They don't seem to be any... Can everybody now access the various MOV? Let me try the PPTX file for 61. It's here. Did other people have that problem with that file? Yeah, do tell me when you have problems. I can't always trace them down. Let's see if the PPTX works. Huh. Okay, so there's something that seems to be wrong with that. But if you want it fixed, send it so I have it in an email and we'll remember. Obviously, I showed this in class, right? I don't know what's going on. Pardon me?
Can we use another computer? We can play the movie.
Let's just try the movie, yeah. Okay. 61. Move. Boy, if that's a general problem, I'm in trouble for Monday. Okay, so let's get rid of that and start it up here. Okay. So this first bit, actually, let me go through it fast, because that just shows how they change. I think everybody knows qualitatively what happens, that the inside peaks, the ones near one another, get strong and the others get weak, and the question is why. As you change the, and this is exactly this case that I was talking about. What we changed here was the frequency of the spectrometer, this is how strong the field is. So as you make the field weaker, the chemical shift difference, which is from here to here, gets smaller, measured in frequency units, which is what we're talking about. But the spin-spin splitting stays the same, So as the chemical shift gets not much bigger than the spin-spin splitting, then you get really drastic differences in intensity. And when it becomes negligible compared to the spin-spin splitting, then you see only one peak, and these flanking peaks become so weak that you don't even see them. Okay, so that's what's going to happen here as we go a little bit further. There, right? You don't even see them anymore. Okay. Pardon me? Why what?
Well, the flanking peaks get weak.
What? I couldn't.
The flanking peaks.
What about the flank? Which they are, you mean?
Why do they get weak?
That's what I'm going to explain now. That's what Yeet asked. Okay, so first we take a gross look and see the energies that are available. Both protons could be with the field, one with and one against, or both against the field. So you have low energy, intermediate energy, and high energy. And you put in energy that gets absorbed, which turns out to be the same as these precession frequencies, right? They could go from here to here or from here to here. Okay, so now when we do that then, there are those transitions. The red ones flip a red spin, the blue ones flip a blue spin, and they're all the same energy, okay? So what you would expect to see in the spectrum then is just one peak, right? But if they have the chemical shifts are very, very small. So we're going to have to magnify things in order to see those. If this is 100 megahertz from here to the average, right, but our difference is only hundreds of hertz, we won't even see it on that first scale. So we blow up the middle and see that the field for the blue spectrum, the local field, was stronger than the field for the red spectrum. Right? So, in fact, it took more energy to flip a blue spin than it took to flip a red spin. Or less energy to flip a red spin than to flip a blue spin. Okay?
Why is that? Isn't this?
Because the local fields are different around the blue nucleus and the red nucleus. They're different places in the molecule. Or they have different neighbors, you know, the neighbors pointing with or against the field. No, we're talking about chemical shift here. Okay, so these are different chemical shifts. Now let me back up just a bit because we went.
The neighbors were all pointing down.
Actually, I should. I'll pause it, and then it won't progress on its own. Okay, so let's get back to where. So there they were all the same, and now we enlarge the field, and we see that there's a subtle difference, just parts per million, right? And then in the spectrum, we see a blue peak and a red peak, right? But the blue here is the same as the blue here, and the red here is the same as the red here. So there's just a red peak and a blue peak. Okay, so far so good. Right? Yeah?
I'm having trouble understanding so the arrows represent the states of individual.
The arrows show the orientation of the proton.
Yeah.
Here they're both oriented with the field in the same direction as the field, so they're low in energy. Here the red one is turned over. Here the blue one is turned over, and up there they're both turned over.
You're not trying to represent actual protons in a sample, you're just saying they could be in this orientation.
No, some molecules have it this way. Some molecules have it this way, some molecules have it that, and some molecules have it that, and the difference in energy, this energy is so small, right, that it's almost 50-50, almost equal populations of all those. But a little bit more here than here than here. Just a little bit, so that, you know, up 1 in 20,000 or something. And that will get bigger if we use a bigger field, right? So we get more sensitive, okay? But anyhow, that's that. Because at the same time that this can go here, right? You can flip the red one up, you can flip it down. And if those are equally populated, this one and this one, those two will cancel. What's giving off energy will be the same as what's absorbing, and you won't see any net change. Yeah, Matt? Now all this, there are two different hydrogens. There's a hydrogen in the blue, there's a blue hydrogen and a red hydrogen. They're different places in the molecule, so they have different local fields, right? One has a local field that gives that chemical shift, the other a local field that gives that chemical shift. Brandon?
Are you referring to this
dynamic?
Are you referring to this dynamic on the previous
slide? It could be. Yeah, that they had different chemical shifts, something like that. But what we're going to get to is that they interact with each other. that's going to be what makes the subtlety. But if all that was the field and the chemical shift of each one, then this is what you'd see, two peaks. Okay? And if this distance here is delta over 2, then notice that the blue one was larger, is larger than the red one by delta over, let's see. This blue one was the original, if I got this right. If I got this wrong, it's looking wrong to me. Yeah, I've got it wrong. I'm sorry if that's confused you. I think it's wrong. The original average, was here. If one got longer by delta over 2 and the other got shorter by delta over 2, then the difference would be delta. Okay? But I've actually done it wrong there. Right? The difference between a red and a blue here is delta over 2. Right? What I showed here was delta. So I've labeled it wrong. Sorry for the confusion. Everybody see what I'm saying? It was the shift, if the shift was delta over 2, this one shifted down, that one shifted up, then it would have been that, but I've labeled it wrong. But this is not a big deal.
The total is delta over 2, so each one shifts delta over 4.
Yeah, each one shifted. If each one shifted by delta over 2, then the difference would be delta. But in fact, I didn't show the shift here. I showed the difference. So it should be the difference there. That should be delta. That is not relevant to what we're talking about. But it's an error. Okay, now we're going to take into account that the spins interact with each other. Right? But that's... So here, they're parallel to one another. There, they're parallel to one another. Here, they're anti-parallel to one another. So if they interact with one another, these two will shift in one direction, but those will shift in the opposite direction. Say they like to be parallel. Okay, these would go down in energy. Those would go down in energy, but these would go up in energy. Everybody with me? I don't see nods. Yeah, it's okay. Okay. Yeah, well, it's shown here. Okay, so now suppose it'll be written here. I can grab it and drag it. Suppose the spins interact favorably when they're anti-parallel. Okay, I had it favorable when they're anti-parallel. So this went down in energy. This went down in energy because they're anti-parallel. But this went up in energy by the same amount, and that one went up in energy compared to what it was originally. Okay? So now, how did that affect the energies that were involved in these transitions? Right? This blue one got shorter by an amount J over 4, okay? Because this moved down and this moved up. And this, by J over 2, right? This one moved down by J over 4. This one moved up by J over 4. So the whole thing got shorter by J over 2, okay? But this blue one got longer by J over 2. Everybody with me? So now when we look at the blue one, one's going to shift by J over 2 in one direction. The other's going to shift by J over 2 in the other direction. And the same thing is happening to the reds. Okay? So we redraw that spectrum then, and it's going to show like that. So there's that splitting is now J, if the shifts were J over 4. Okay?
Does that represent the chemical shift?
It represents the energy of the transition.
Okay, so...
Right? And before, earlier, let's just back up just a bit. Here, at this stage, at that stage, the difference only had, the difference between blue and red was due to different chemical shifts, the delta part. Okay? But then we considered the interaction between the two nuclei. And then we did additional shifts, and I haven't got the spectrum yet. That changed just a little bit later. There's the chemical shift. Okay? But then when we shift the levels again, because the spins are interacting, and the middle ones go down and the outer ones go up in energy, then that causes this splitting. Okay, so that's the J splitting. So from here to here is due to chemical shift, right? And from here to here is due to J.
Why is it J instead of J
over 2? Why is it what? No, no, the blue, this blue one got shorter. If this shifted down by J over 4 and this shifted up by J over 4, this, the whole blue thing got shorter by J over 2. But that one got longer by J over 2. So one went down by J over 2, the other went up by J over 2. The difference is J. Okay? Now the high order effects. So this is what the person who was asking me didn't understand. Okay? So J does something else besides just shifting these levels. It also causes this state and this state to mix with one another. Right? And it doesn't mix these with these, because this is an enormous distance. The energy match is terrible. But these are very near one another. Remember, we magnified it a lot to see that there was any difference at all. Okay? So it mixes those two. Now, I didn't tell you why it mixes it. I just said that it mixes it. And if it perfectly mixed it, then the two states would be A plus B and A minus B. Right? And you've seen things like that before in making bonds. Right? Let's just go to that. Over on the left there, you'll see it once I drag a little bit. Right? So if you take a carbon orbital and an oxygen orbital and you put them together, and I didn't change the colors here, but this should be the blue, blue, red, red. So bonding and antibonding, right? And the energy match wasn't perfect, so that they don't mix symmetrically, right? The lower one has more oxygen than carbon, this one has more carbon than oxygen. And the same thing happens here, right? You mix this one with this one, you get one that's mostly this, the higher one, one that's mostly the lower one, right? But a little bit of the other one and a little bit of the other one. And the signs, we're accustomed to saying that the sum is low and the difference is high. In this case, it turns out that it's the other way around, but that's no big deal. Okay, so anyhow, the energies shift a little bit because of that mixing. If the energy match had been perfect, right, then they would have mixed completely, and it would have been these would have been the two states. But because their energy match wasn't right, they just mixed a little bit. But at any rate, this one goes up a little bit, and this one goes down a little bit. Now, what does that do? It doesn't affect this down here, because it was too far away to be mixed with anything. Its energy didn't change, right? But these two changed. So this blue one was here before, and now it's here. It got a little bit longer. Okay? And how about this blue one? What did it do when they mixed? The one that went from here, it went from here to here originally, and now it goes from here to here. Did it get longer or shorter? Both the blue ones got longer, and both the red ones got shorter. Right? So what that's going to mean is that the reds go one way, and the blues go another way. But it doesn't change the difference, the J's. Right? Because the difference between the two reds is just the same as it was before. Remember, this red, which became this one, is different from this red. This one's longer and this one's shorter. That's the J. Right? But they both got shorter in doing this. By the same amount. The amount this one went down was the amount that one went up. So it doesn't change the difference between them, it just shifts them. So that shift is then shown here. So the reds move up and the blues move down in frequency. There, like that. Okay? So now the average of these is no longer the chemical shift, because they both got shifted up. These both got shifted down. Okay? So that's a higher order effect, and you don't usually worry about that. But the more interesting higher order effect for our purposes is that this one, what it actually means is that they point in opposite directions along the magnetic field. They cancel each other along the magnetic field. But perpendicular to the magnetic field, they reinforce. Whereas these cancel one another altogether. So this one is not magnetic. Right? But this one is magnetic. It's just not magnetic in the direction of the field. It's magnetic perpendicular to the field. And that's what's going to say that here shortly.
That's why there is energy.
Right? So this is just as... If the two, in this state here where they were both with the field, they actually, remember, pointed at an angle to the field. So one is like that, the other is like that. And perpendicular to the field, they have that much magnetism. Right? And this one, the same. When they're both against the field, they have that much horizontal magnetism. But this one has just as much horizontal magnetism. And remember, that horizontal magnetism is what you see in the... That's the thing that's going at 100 megahertz, the horizontal component. So this one is, this one, if they were perfectly mixed, this one's just as magnetic as these. But this one's not magnetic at all. So the minus one, the one here, goes away with respect to whether it's magnetic. But this one is magnetic. And in the limit, it's as magnetic as the top and bottom ones. So now, it won't surprise you, although I didn't give you all the details of how it works, that this the transitions involving this state, which is magnetic, are now very strong. But the ones involving this state are now very weak. And I think that's what happens next here. Sorry, I don't have it. Right? So this blue one and that red one that involve this one get very strong, but the ones that involve here, the red one here and the blue one there, get very weak in their interaction with the field. So now the outer ones turn out to be the ones that get weak and the inner ones get strong. So it's like that. So that's what causes it. And this is not something, I mean, this is pretty high level stuff, and it's not the main thing that you should be spending your time on, and it's not going to be the focus of a lot of stuff on the exam, not at this level anyhow. The fact that they're distorted, I think, is easily remembered, that the outer ones get weak and the inner ones get strong. But I want you to ask questions like, why is it that way, and this is why. Okay? So that's that. Poi? Or Roy?
Do the integrals of the inner ones increase, or
does what?
By the integrals of the inner ones increase.
Yeah, the overall integral stays the same. This one gets stronger to the same extent that this one gets weaker. And in fact, the weighted although the average of these two frequencies here is bigger than that, the weighted average is that. Because you weight this one more strongly than that one. So the amount by which this one gains magnetism is exactly balanced by how much that one loses magnetism.
So is the area under each of those still one? Or?
Yeah.
But then, why would one suddenly go up?
Why does one get stronger?
Yeah, what is meant by intensity? We don't really look at the vertical axis.
Well, you can look at, there are other peaks in the same spectrum that are not split. So you compare there, so say that you had a methyl singlet there, right? It integrates to three protons. If the red bit is one proton, it'll be the total of the sum of the integrals of the big peak and the little peak will be one compared to the unsplit methyl peak being three. Okay. Megan?
Could you go over again how that relates to why the CH4 has an unsplit campus?
Yeah, because in the CH4, all the four hydrogens have the same chemical shift. Right? So if they had different chemical shifts and coupled, then you'd see if there were just two of them, or if there were four of them, you'd see a quartet. Each proton would be split by three others into 1-3-3-1 peaks. Right? But then as the chemical shifts become similar, the outer peaks fade away and the inner peaks get stronger of those quartets until when they have no difference in chemical shift, you only see the one peak. And in methane, obviously, they all have the same chemical shift. Or the three hydrogens of a methyl group have the same chemical shift. In fact, Professor Saunders, who likes NMR and likes isotopes, was talking to me in my office the other day and explaining to me or haranguing me that if you have a methyl group that has hydrogen and deuterium and tritium, three different isotopes of hydrogen, then it'll rotate. But it's not the same energy for different, because they have different amounts of vibration. So in an environment where they run into things, the tritium, the heaviest, is the smallest. It doesn't vibrate as much. So it wants to be in the area that's small, right? So they don't average to the same chemical shift. Of course, you wouldn't know it exactly because they're different nuclei, right? They're not the same nucleus. But anyhow, they could be different chemical shifts. But the cool thing is people went to a lot of work to make hydrogen, deuterium, tritium, methyl group that was just one hand, right or left-handed. But when they succeeded, how did they know it? How did they know that it was all right-handed? The way they did was have that methyl group be in a molecule where there's another chiral center. And the average phase of rotation is a little different for right-handed and left-handed if it's in the same molecule with a right-handed center. So you get different chemical shifts for the hydrogens. So you can have different chemical shifts for a methyl group, but not if they're three H's, because then obviously they're all three the same. So if you have the same chemical shift, the nuclei do interact with each other magnetically, as you would expect them to, but the peaks that would come from it become infinitesimally small and you can't see them. So it's not that they don't couple, it's that you can't observe it. Yeah?
Can we please look at why the OH peaks are different for ethanol in different solvents?
Yeah, because in some... is that... Which lecture is that? We could. I don't know. Maybe I should give up on this now. I don't know what's wrong with my computer. So the chemical shifts of everything depends on solvent, because what's on time average in solvent, you average the environment, but you have a different environment if it's carbon tetrachloride and a bunch of chlorines around your thing than if it's benzene solvent or hydrocarbon solvent. Okay, so in the infrared, OHs can be hydrogen bonded or not hydrogen bonded, right? And it doesn't surprise you that those have different vibration frequencies. It's easier to stretch in one, or does it surprise you? You know, if something else is pulling on it, it has a different frequency than if it's just alone. That's not surprising. It's like putting another spring in. Okay? Typically, you see in the IR spectrum of an alcohol, you see a peak that looks like this, and a peak that looks like this, right? And this is OHs that are standing alone, and these are ones that are hydrogen bonded, okay? Now, if you put it in a solvent like dimethyl sulfoxide, two methyls on sulfur and then oxygen, this is a very polar bond. So it hydrogen bonds very strongly with an alcohol, right? And now if this is the solvent, all of the OHs are going to be hydrogen bonded like that, and there are not going to be any of them that are just dangling out in space. So you'll see just one frequency, and I don't know exactly what the frequency is, but say here. But if it's in a normal solvent, then some of them will be, then they'll be hydrogen bonded sometimes in triangles like this. So you can have that kind of hydrogen bonding. Okay? But you can also have chains of hydrogen bond, and these will all have different frequencies in here for the hydrogen bonded things. Right? And obviously it's going to depend on concentration. Because the more concentrated it is, the more hydrogen bonding you're going to have. Maybe you could be more specific in what seems challenging to you about it. No, so I was talking about IR.
Yeah, I think I showed you the wrong slide.
So in NMR, the hydrogen bonds aren't very. How strong are hydrogen bonds? How many kilocalories per mole? Do you know? Anybody know? Yeah. How many kilocalories? Now, how strong is an OH bond? You know, a covalent OH bond of an alcohol. Order, you don't have to be close. Jack, what do you say? It's actually stronger, I think. It's more like 105 or something, but it's about 100 kilocalories per mole. It's a regular old bond. How strong is a hydrogen bond that holds one alcohol to another? Antonia? No. Five. 20 times weaker. So it breaks very easily compared to an OH bond. Okay? So if you have, so the rate at which alcohols are changing partners in hydrogen bonds is very, very fast. How fast would it be? Suppose you have to break a bond that costs 5 kilocalories per mole. What should the rate constant be? How do you get the rate constant if you know the energy barrier? It's 10 to the 13th per second times 10 to the minus 3/4 delta H. So if delta H is about 4, it's times 10 to the minus 3. So 10 to the 10th times per second, it's changing partners. Right? Now, the difference in frequency in the NMR, the difference in chemical shift for being hydrogen bonded one way and being hydrogen bonded another way, might be at 60 megahertz, 10 parts per million, let's say. Right? 10 parts per million out of 60 million. So 10 times 60 is 600 hertz. Right? So they'd be 600 hertz different. But it's changing from being in one way to the other 10 to the 10th hertz. So it's averaging very fast compared to the difference in frequency. So you just see one peak for it. Okay, for the hydrogen bonded. But if you want to go from an OH from one molecule to another, then it has to break the OH bond. And that's more like, if you were just going to break it into radicals, it would be 100 kilocalories per mole, 3/4 of which is 75. Right? No way that's going to happen at all. 10 to the minus 75 times 10 to the plus 13th is 10 to the minus 60th per second. Right? Never. Right? If you put acid in there, then the acid can go on the O, and your proton can then come off. So now you have a way of, the more acid you put in, the faster this will happen. Right? So if you have acid in there, then you can get exchange that will average the spin-spin splitting. Remember, because the OH, the hydrogen connected to oxygens in different molecules will have different neighbors on the carbon. Two up, two down, one up, one down. So it will come at different positions. But if it goes from one molecule to another, some of them will have both up, some will both down, some one up, some down, they'll average. So if you have acid in there that allow the hydrogens to go from molecule to molecule rapidly, then rapidly compared with the frequency difference, which is like 10 hertz, something like that. The J coupling is like 10 hertz. So if it's happening 10 times a second or much faster than that, then it'll collapse to a single line and you won't see the spin-spin splitting. Brandon?
This is kind of unrelated, but I'm just wondering for like beta-carotene, how does light get a handle on that?
Why what?
For beta-carotene, how does light get a handle on the pi orbitals because there's no oxygen or
other? There's a nitrogen.
For beta-carotene,
sorry. Yeah, in beta-carotene, you have, I was thinking of rhodopsin. In beta carotene, it's not an N, that's called, in the carotene, in the rhodopsin, it's called N to pi star, and that's what I talked about in class. But for the carotene, it's pi to pi star, right? Which is a little harder to understand how it works. And I don't think that I'm going to spend the time to talk about that now.
Okay, I have another question.
Yeah.
For the two protons in the middle of the ethanol, why do they make a doublet of quartets instead of a quartet of doublets?
That's just a different way of defining it. They're splitting into four if they were on top of one another, and then split into two. Right? But you could also say there are four doublets, right? It's just a different way of talking about it.
And then, like, why are some peaks shorter than their, like, peaks?
That's this, that, they, well, there's the, you know, there's the general binomial 1-3-3-1, that kind of stuff. But on top of that, you get some a little shorter and some a little stronger because of these higher order effects that we talk about, where the outer peaks get, when you have protons here and protons here splitting each other, the outer peaks get weak and the inner peaks get strong.
But even for even for the peaks that correspond to each other.
Yeah, like if you have a, let me draw it over here. The ideal, okay, let's do a quartet of doublets. So doublet splitting is 1-1, and quartet splitting is 1-3-3-1. So ideally, it would look like this: 1-3-3-1, right? And the splitting from here to here, or here to here, or here to here would be the J splitting for the quartet. And the splitting from here to here is the J splitting for the doublet, drawn much small, it's supposing it to be much smaller, right? It could be that this one was bigger than this one, and then you'd get a somewhat different pattern. But you might call this one a quartet of doublets and call the other one a doublet of quartets if you wanted to. Okay, so now, suppose the single proton that's causing the doublet splitting is down here. Right, and it's, and if this is a, suppose this is one proton, it's actually two. Okay, suppose it's two protons. Suppose this is one proton, and up here there are three protons, right? So the splitting of this signal by the single proton is making it a doublet. The splitting by the three protons is making it a quartet. Okay, and the interaction between this and this is bigger than the interaction between this and this. Okay? So this one should be a triplet, and it should show that splitting, 1-2-1. Okay, and the up here should be a triplet as well, but it'll be a lot bigger because it's three protons, 1, and it'll have this split, this bigger splitting, 1-2-1. Okay, so that's the first order spectrum that we expect. Okay? But now the higher order effects make outer peaks weak and inner peaks stronger. Okay? So with respect to the doublet splitting here, this is an outer peak and this is an inner peak because this one's far from what's doing the splitting. This is nearer. Clearly in this one, this will get stronger and this will get weaker. Okay, the inner peaks get strong when something here is splitting this. The outer peaks get weak. But the same thing will happen here. This will get stronger. This will get weaker. 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 Okay? But within the quartet, these are the ones that are doing the splitting, right? So this gets stronger. This gets weaker. Okay? But these get stronger, these get weaker. These get a little bit stronger, these get a little bit weaker. Okay? So the asymmetry of the doublet is slanting up this way, but if the quartet is slanting up that way. Is that what you were asking about? And it can get really hairy when you have lots of protons of different chemical shifts interacting with one another. Because then I had drawn this scheme here of these different levels. You have a zillion levels when you have, this is just for two protons. If you have lots, there are all sorts of things in here and they're all mixing with one another and some a little stronger than the others. And it gets, that's what happened in that spectrum that was back a ways here, the one for the benzenes that were part of that molecule. Let's get back just a bit. Right, so these peaks in here are very, very complicated for that reason, because you have all those protons on these protons are all splitting each other with different chemical shifts and so on, yeah. Yeah, this is, for example, ethanol under condition where it's not exchanging rapidly. So you have OH interacting with CH2, interacting with CH3. So up here is the signal from CH3. CH3, which is being split by the CH2 in the middle into a triplet. Right? Down here is the OH, which is interacting with the CH2 in the middle, being split into a triplet. And the CH2 in the middle is being split into a quartet by the three that are the CH3 and into a doublet with a smaller splitting by the OH. Okay. Once burned, twice shy here. The last couple lectures I've had an extra slide about NMR that I was just going to let you practice on that's taken from the last year's exam. I can see if I can show that if you want to see it. You want to see that? What time we got? We got just a little time here still. Let's see. I don't know what's going on with my PowerPoint. But let me just see if I can get open. What is it? It's 66, this one here. See if that one works. So this is what we had today, but I think it still has in it the ones that, yeah, this one. Okay, so this question was that this is the spectrum of that molecule. And you're supposed to interpret it as what's A, B, C, D, and understand the pattern. Okay? So let's, I think I've got this animated. So A, which protons in that molecule are giving A, do you think? What information do you have that's going to help you know that? What information are you using to figure it out? Well, there are three kinds of information for peak A, or for the pattern A. What are the three elements of information about it? The splitting, the integration, and the chemical shift. Okay, so now, what about with respect to the integration? It should be small, so it's not very many protons compared to the others. Okay, how about the chemical shift? It's shifted far down, right? It's got a big chemical shift. What does that mean? There's something electronegative around. And how about the spin-spin splitting? Cassie? There are two protons, three bonds away, right? Your proton attached to an atom that has attached to it two protons. Okay, so which one is it? Oh, it's okay, good. Okay, so that one's A. Okay, now what's B? I gotta turn off the automatic advance here. Okay, so A. How about B? Who said? It's CH2s. Now, why do you say that? So it looks like it has three H's nearby.
And it's also pretty far to the left, which they would both be
connected to
the O6.
Because the carbon on which they are is attached to oxygen. Notice that the carbon on which A is also attached to oxygen. In fact, it's attached to two oxygens. These aren't split as sent down as far because their carbon is attached to only one oxygen. Okay, so that's reasonable to be B. Okay, now what's C? The CH2CN, so it's shifted down by the cyanobian electron withdrawing, right? This is two hydrogens where that's one. Their areas look about right. And what else besides the split? Besides the chemical shift and the integral. The spin-spin splitting, it's got a doublet, so it's next to a carbon, it's on a carbon that whose next carbon has just one hydrogen. That looks good for the one with CN, okay? And finally, there are going to be six protons in the methyl group, okay? So it's the biggest signal, and it's split by the CH2 into that. So that's D. Okay, essentially everybody got that, which made me happy. Right, but now there's a problem with B. What's the problem with B? It's a quartet of doublets. Where you said it was a quartet, right?
Yeah.
So why is it a quartet of doublets?
The CH2 must not be exactly equal.
So you say the C. Okay, what some people said on the test was that there's a little bit of splitting with a single proton that make it a little bit of a doublet. That is, there could be long-range splitting between, what they were saying, was that A is splitting B, right? It's through one more bond. They're further away. But then again, the splitting is pretty small. What can you say about that, Chris?
They're diastereotomic because they're bonded to carbon.
That's the answer. But in the meantime, why can't it be spin-spin splitting by A? So that you could just look and see that if this is not being split by A. How do you know?
Because
A is not being split by B. If B influences A, A will influence B. Right? So it's not spin-spin splitting because none of the others show extra splitting. Right? So it must be a difference in chemical shift. Now let's look. Okay, and what's E, incidentally? There's another peak there. That's the TMS, okay. Now, there we have, those are both 7 hertz, so they're splitting each other, right? But the question is, what's that? It can't be long-range splitting from A because A is not split, okay? That just shows the 7 hertz triplet from interacting with the C protons. Okay. Now, if we make that central carbon tetrahedral to see what the molecule actually looks like, you see that there's a plane of symmetry, right, perpendicular to the board. So the top is the mirror image of the bottom. Okay. So the D protons on top should be like the D protons on the bottom, and this hydrogen of the CH2 is the mirror image of that hydrogen of the CH2, and if they're mirror images, they have the same chemical shift. Right? That makes sense. Okay, and the top ethoxy group is the mirror image of the bottom ethoxy group. So they should be the same. So those are enantiotopic, right? The top and the bottom, they're mirror image environments, so they should be the same. So the top ethyl group should have the same spectrum as the bottom ethyl group, okay, because they're mirror images. However, as Chris points out, so they'll have the same chemical shift unless you put it in a solvent that was only one hand. Then it would interact more with the one that's R than with the one that's S of those two mirror images. So then you could make them different, right? But it's in carbon tetrachloride or something like that, or chloroform. Okay, so it's not that. Okay, but now how about those two hydrogens? How about the environment of the top and the bottom H hydrogen there? Is there a mirror plane there that makes the top equivalent to the bottom? Well, at first glance, you might think there is, right? But that those two might be enantiotopic and therefore have the same chemical shift. But what's interesting, so suppose you made one of them deuterium and the other one hydrogen, right? Then locally, that would be R or S we could figure out, right? Deuterium higher priority than hydrogen. Okay, so that center is chiral, right? So are they enantiotopic? Are they mirror image environments? No, because that carbon is chiral too with respect to this group. It could be right-handed or left-handed going ACB, right? So in fact, as Chris said, they're actually diastereotopic, those two of the CH2. So they have slightly different chemical shifts. So these are two different quartets at different chemical shifts, each of them being split by whatever they're being split by the CH3 group into a quartet. So that, I think, nobody got. And I wasn't surprised. But sometimes I put in things like, you know, this had things that were easier to understand, so people got a lot of credit. But it's always worth seeing whether someone's going to see something that's really hard. Laura?
So can we tell which one is down and which one is up?
No. The difference is very small in the first place, and I don't think anybody understands chemical shifts that way, that well. And furthermore, it would depend on conformation, right? It would be actually, these would both be averages over different conformations, right? So you'd have not only to be able to predict the chemical shifts of a given conformation, but you'd have to get the correct average over the different conformations. So it would be a really, really tough job.
And just really doesn't matter.
I would say it doesn't matter. But, you know, if you're interested in NMR, that might be an interesting thing to study. I could see that it would be interesting to study. So it was worth asking the question, but I don't know how to do it. Maybe you'll figure that out someday. Cassie?
Could you point out a few things that would change if you were to make the NMR field a lot weaker?
If you make the NMR field weaker, the J's stay the same. So the splitting stays the same. But as the chemical shift measured in frequency gets smaller, right, then the peaks begin to distort, right? In the first place, they all come on top of one another, so they're not resolved anymore. You can't see the difference. You know, if this was measured at 60 megahertz. If you measured at a much higher field, you know, this would be way over there, this would be, right? If you plotted it on the same paper, these things would look very small, right? Because this gets much bigger, and that splitting stays the same. So when you look at high field spectra, they just look a lot more like lines than like splitting patterns. You have to blow them up to see that they're triplets and quartets and stuff like that. Okay. Another thing that happens when you get a bigger field is you get stronger signals for the reasons that Yeet was asking about earlier. So if you want to do biological things where you're dealing with big molecules, so not many protons in a sample, if you have really big molecules, something that's just one proton in a big molecule is not nearly as strong a signal as a zillion protons in a lot of tiny of the same kind in a lot of tiny molecules. Right, so if you're going to do biology, it's good to have a really big field, right, to get the maximum sensitivity and to spread things out so they're not all on top of one another. right? And when you have a bigger field, notice how this is weaker than that. So what's splitting that is downfield from it, which isn't surprising because this is all the way up here. And notice here, it's sloping up. That's this higher order effect. And if you look at the quartet, it's sloping up here, right? Because the quartet splitting here is being caused by this. Okay, so that's a hint. So, but as you make the chemical shift bigger by using a bigger field, the chemical shift is the same, like 9 parts per million. But the frequency difference gets bigger, which is what you compare to J. So those become more ideal as you do that. And these already are easily seen that it's a triplet, a quartet, and so on. But in that spectrum we looked at a short time ago where you had those benzene things all hairy on top of one another, if you put that in a big field, those would start looking like reasonable, interpretable patterns. Okay? Yeah. Also, incidentally, when you have higher frequencies, you need a higher frequency differences, as the chemical shift gets exaggerated in frequency terms by having a big field. Now you need higher frequencies to cause averaging if you have the reactions going on. So you can freeze a molecule for purposes of exchange being slow by making the field big. Right, so you can look at different rates by different fields. Yeah.
Can we go over the orbital like tracking thing when you did convocation dissertation lecture 56?
Yeah.
Just before we begin, what was C had to equal B?
Yeah, this one, why isn't this second order, you're saying? And let's see, that doublet is being caused by this, right? C is being split by now that's interesting, and I don't truly understand. You'd think that the amount of sloping up here should be matched by the sloping down here, since these things are splitting each other, right? And that's what's worrying you. And I don't know. Sorry. The amount of the second order effect is not really dramatic here. If it were more, if you worked in a smaller field, so these things got closer to one another in chemical shift, then this would distort more, and I'm sure it would show what you wanted to see. Okay, now to, so this is 60 what lecture? 60 what? Or 50?
56.
56. See if my PowerPoint will handle that one. 56. Which slide are we interested in here?
Down. It's that one.
This one?
Down two.
Here? Okay, so let's see. Okay, so track the molecular orbitals of hexatriene as they transfer into those of cyclohexadiene. Okay, so here's hexatriene, which is 3p orbitals in a row. Or probably 3 double bonds, 6p orbitals in a row. So they're going to be 6 molecular orbitals from 6 atomic orbitals, and they're going to be none of them have the same energy. They'll be low, next, okay? No nodes, 1 node, 2 node, 3 nodes, okay? And that's what these are. And they're a little closer to the together at the bottom than in the middle, because remember you draw that circle and evenly space along the circumference, but that means that they're closer together vertically here than they are here. Okay, so that's on both sides. No matter which way it rotates, it starts with those energies. And then when you get to the product here, there's a sigma and a sigma star that are very low and very high. This isn't to scale. It's the same in both cases. It's the same kind of molecule you're going to. And then 4p orbitals in a row. So psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4. And now there's the question of which of these orbitals in the starting material becomes which of these orbitals in the product. Okay? So, now, and notice the difference that if you have, proceeding on me here. Let me go back and kill that and we'll start again. Okay, so now, in the Möbius, there's a p orbital in the start on each of these, but it started to rotate. So here the original p orbital was pointing up and down, is now pointing that way. And this one is back that way a little bit, this way, this way, this way, and this way. Okay, and then with the mirror there. The crucial thing is that the ones on the end, the p orbital here is pointing that way, the p orbital here is pointing that way. Okay? And over here, the p orbital here is pointing this way, and the p orbital here is pointing this way. So it's this way on one, and this way in con rotation. Okay? And the crucial thing that's going to happen is the bottom of this one is going to touch the top of that one. And here, the top of this one is going to touch the top of that one. So this is Huckel connectivity, and this is what's called Möbius connectivity when you preserve the axis as it rotates. Okay. Now, the lowest orbital, one here, had no nodes, right? So it was red on top, 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 red on top. But the top here is touching the bottom here. So the red is touching the blue. So you're getting a node, right? So you're getting an orbital that has a node in it. Now, sigma doesn't have a node in it. Psi 1 doesn't have a node in it over here, right? Up. Psi 2 has a node in it, a node that goes down like that, okay? So this Psi 1 here must be becoming Psi 2 as you rotate. Over here, the top is touching the top, right? So it's not creating something with a node. So psi 1 here can become sigma. Okay, so see if that's...
You have psi 1 going to psi 1.
What?
On the Möbius commutation, you have psi 1 going to psi
1. Let's see, what am I doing? Okay, so psi... So what I'm analogizing it to here is what happens. That preserves mirror. No, psi 1 becomes sigma. And now, why does psi 1 become psi 1? I see what happens, how we avoid that in front. It's because as it goes along, the ones in front just disappear, right? These are the ones here become smaller, so they don't. So this particular orbital, in fact, doesn't touch and have a node in front where they actually contact. And here it's red, so it becomes red, 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 red. Here it's red with blue. But there's no there because these are getting smaller. That's why I just said it wrong, right? But you pointed out the right thing. Okay, and this is okay. Now psi 2 looks like this, and now that becomes let's see, what have I got here? So psi 2 goes up it with, so at the top is Huckel connectivity, right? As if it were going to benzene. And that's psi 2, when the ends touch, it gets a node, and you can see that here. It's getting a node here, right? And that one is building up to become sigma, I think. Is that right? Yeah, so that one's becoming psi 2 with its pi node. And on the left, yeah, it's becoming sigma. Okay? And then psi 3 in the benzene case is forming psi 1. I think, let's see. Yeah, so it becomes psi 1, and then the one on the left, psi 3, becomes psi 3, not psi 2, which has the wrong number of nodes. I put the exclamation point here, because that's the really crucial one, that these are the occupied orbitals, and these are the occupied orbitals in the product, but you're going not toward the occupied orbital, you're going toward a higher energy orbital here. Whereas in this case, the ones that you start with go to all the occupied orbitals. Right? So it's allowed on the right and forbidden on the left.
So the psi 3 goes to psi 3 because there
it is. Let's look at it. Psi 3. I get carried away with trying to make things accurate and realistic, and drawing things like this, which are the way the orbitals really look, rather than doing schematic ones that might be easier to see. So let's look at psi 3 has two nodes, right? So at the start, it has, let's say, it has two nodes as we go around. But let's just put it in as if they're all the same size, and not worry about the difference. Okay, so it has. So it starts here. Let's say it has nodes here and here. So plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus. Okay? Now, if we do con rotation and touch top to bottom here, right, this is going to go uphill in energy, not down. And it'll create this thing that has... Yeah, it'll create in the pi system, when we've done this here, it'll create something in the pi system that has two nodes. And that's psi 3 of the pi system. Right? Because psi 1 looks like this, of the 4p orbital system. And psi 2 has a node here. And psi 3 is that. So this one, when we're losing in the front and gaining in the back, is going to go to psi 3, not to psi 2. Because psi 2 has that node there. Or psi 2, psi 2 has this node. This doesn't have that node. It has these two nodes. So it goes to psi 3. But with the Huckel, when they touch top to top, then it works. Right? It goes to psi 1. Okay, that's... I can't take any more. I was up till 4 o'clock this morning doing today's PowerPoint. This is a long day. Pardon me?
Psi 1 in the
product,
think you have a node or not?
Psi 1 doesn't have a node. It's those four at the back. No nodes. Yeah.